From national news in D.C. to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol, this is your Capitol Connection. And now, bringing the Capitol to you, here's your host, Nate Graz.
And welcome to Capitol Connection, where we are bringing the Capitol to you every week from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln. We've got a great show today, plenty of important topics to get to. We're going to talk about where Americans find meaning in life. A great new report from the Pew Research Center offers some important insight. We'll also talk about how public schools are getting into the spirit of Christmas by banning all Christmas songs that mention Jesus. You know, the whole reason for the season. Plus, why chicken sandwiches keep triggering universities and students. And lastly, how to win your next argument. But first, here locally, Nebraska state senators are busy meeting and strategizing for next year's legislative session starting January 9th, coming up quick. There will be 13 new state senators in our legislature out of the 49 total. And importantly, on the first day of session, the body will elect committee chairs who wield a lot of power in determining what legislation makes it to the floor for full debate, when committee hearings are, how quickly they advance a bill out or keep it bottled up in committee. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes action and jockeying taking place right now for leadership positions and seats on certain committees. But no one knows for sure how this will all play out until that first day of session and the senators cast their votes to decide who the committee chairs will be. And keep in mind, this is done through a secret ballot process. This has been an issue and an ongoing debate for years. State senators choose their committee chairs from the body by a secret ballot. People, the general public, do not know who their state senator votes for these crucial leadership positions. Conservative state senators tried to change this rule a couple of years ago to make it an open vote so that people and the general public and state senators know who's voting for who. Again, this is a really important vote. The senators that are chosen as the committee chairs and as speaker control an incredible amount of what does and does not happen inside the body for those 2 years. And so on the one hand, you have arguments about protecting the integrity of the body and trying to maintain bipartisanship. And apparently enough senators think that they can do that by keeping this a secret process. And on the other hand, you have arguments that we want honesty and transparency and that constituents, the people who sent you there to represent them when you vote, know what your vote is for the Speaker of the Legislature or the Chair of Judiciary or HHS or Education, these really vital committees. Did you cast your vote for the conservative nominee or the liberal nominee? Who did you choose to represent you and, by extension, your constituents on those committees in those extremely important leadership roles? But again, it will be another secret process. So we will have to wait to see exactly how this plays out on January 9th. And we will, of course, keep you updated when that happens and throughout the legislative session. And you can, of course, visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org to get all of the latest information and happenings from the state capitol. Now, at the federal level out in Washington, D.C., Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi won her party's nomination for Speaker of the House of Representatives for the next congressional session. This happened in a closed caucus session last Wednesday, where again, Nancy Pelosi won her party's nomination for Speaker of the House. Democrats voted 203-32 for Pelosi, who ran unopposed after some fierce infighting and possible challenges from other elected congressmen and women from her own party. Congresswoman Pelosi, of course, previously served as Speaker from 2007 till 2011. But keep in mind, the entire House will have to vote on Congresswoman Pelosi being Speaker of the House. She won her party's nomination, but the entire House will vote on that nomination. And from what we can tell, she will probably have to flip about 15 votes as it stands right now to secure that seat on January 3rd. And according to World News, Pelosi has been meeting with some of her critics in Congress, trying to gain their support. Other Democrats who are pushing for fresh faces in leadership, and they are asking for Pelosi to forecast when she would transition out of the Speaker's role in exchange for their support. So this all sounds like typical DC politics, but again, this same sort of thing is happening here locally in our own state house in Lincoln, but we still don't know how it's all going to play out here. Now, for a larger, more difficult, but more important question, what makes life meaningful? Answering such a big question might be challenging for most people. Even among researchers, there is little consensus about the best way to measure what brings human beings satisfaction and fulfillment. Traditional survey questions with pre-specified response options may not capture important sources of meaning. So to tackle this topic, Pew Research Center conducted two separate surveys in late 2017. The first included an open-ended question asking Americans to describe in their own words what makes their lives feel meaningful, fulfilling, or satisfying. This approach gives respondents an opportunity to describe the myriad of things they find meaningful, from careers, faith, family, to hobbies, pets, travel, music, or even just being outdoors. The second survey included a set of closed-ended questions asking Americans to rate how much meaning and fulfillment they draw from each of 15 possible sources identified by the research team. It also included a question asking which of these sources gives respondents the most meaningful and fulfillment in their lives. This approach offers a limited series of options, but provides a measure of the relative importance Americans place on various sources of meaning in their lives. So, what should we take away from this survey? What were the results? Across both surveys, the most popular answer is clear and consistent. Americans are most likely to mention family when asked what makes life meaningful in the open-ended question. And they are most likely to report that they find a great deal of meaning in spending time with family in the closed-ended question. In fact, according to the Pew Research Center, nearly 70% of Americans chose family when describing what provides them with a sense of meaning. Nearly 70% said family. We know very clearly that economic, religious, and increasingly political divides shape where we all find meaning. But as this research shows, family and friendship emerge as common themes that drive our ultimate sense of meaning. We need to remember that. And policymakers need to remember that when they're contemplating legislation, that the state is not supposed to be the family, that parents should have the freedom to control their child's education, that children need to be raised by parents who love them, not by disconnected government officials, because when it comes to children, parents are better at raising them than the government. But if we remain silent, parental rights, religious freedom rights, and free speech rights will continue to slip away. Look at what is happening right now in Texas, in a very red, very conservative state. A father is on the brink of losing custody of his 6-year-old son because the father has not affirmed or gone along with the boy's mother's claim that the child, again a 6-year-old boy, is a transgender girl. Now the father is fighting for his son in court after pushing back on his ex-wife's claim. According to court documents, the young boy only dresses as a girl when he's with his mother, who has enrolled him in first grade as a female. The father, however, contends that his son consistently chooses to wear boys' clothes, violently refuses to wear girls' clothes at his home, and identifies as a boy when he is with his father. Now, the Federalist is reporting that the mother in this situation has accused the father of child abuse in their divorce proceedings for not affirming James, the young 6-year-old boy, as transgender, and is trying to strip the father of his parental rights. She is also seeking to require the father to pay for the child's visits to a transgender-affirming therapist and transgender medical alterations, which may include hormonal sterilization starting at age 8. According to the Daily Wire, the father has been legally barred from speaking to his child about sexuality and gender from a scientific or religious perspective, and from dressing his son in boys' clothes. Instead, he has to offer both girls' and boys' outfits. However, the boy consistently refuses to wear dresses, according to the father. Again, the father in this scenario has been legally barred by the state, his own government, from speaking to his own six-year-old child about sexuality and gender from a scientific or religious perspective. Think about that. If your state government showed up at your door and told you, no, you don't know what's best for your child who's 6 years old, but we do, and don't even think about talking to them about these deeply personal and difficult issues. That's not your role as a parent anymore. That's our job. And forget what science says. Forget what the Word of God says. Forget about your religious beliefs, because you don't know what's best. And if you don't abide by what we have said, you will lose custody of your own child for not wanting a six-year-old biological boy to go through harmful and irreversible hormone treatment and transgender surgery before even going through puberty. And this is all happening because the boy was diagnosed with gender dysphoria by a gender transition therapist that his mother chose for the son to see. And again, according to the Daily Wire, listen to this. According to the therapist's notes, the boy chose to identify as a girl when he was in sessions alone with his mother. Alternatively, he chose to identify as a boy when he was in sessions alone with his father. According to documents filed in court under the skilled eyes of the therapist, the child was presented two pieces of paper, one with the word James and one with the word Luna, his given female name by his mother, and asked to pick the name he preferred. When the appointment only included his mother, James selected Luna, the name and gender he uses at his mother's home and in his first grade classroom, because that's the way that his mother enrolled him in the school. But when the appointment was only with his father, James pointed to the boy named James and not the girl name. Moreover, the father has collected testimony from parents of his son's friends and a church leader who say they have only seen the six-year-old identify as a male. The boy's pastor said, quote, "Based on the three occasions I've spent time with him, I'd say he acts and looks unmistakably like a healthy six-year-old boy. I am praying for him, an average six-year-old boy, a sweet-natured, intelligent, lovable, and at this point particularly vulnerable young man caught up in a titanic clash of worldviews." Another family friend said, quote, "His mother came to pick up the boys to take them to his brother's soccer game. He hugged his dad and said, 'I love you.' He refused to go to the soccer game as a girl with his mom and stayed with dad. That evening they came to our house." So needless to say, the gender dysphoria diagnosis is being contested by the boy's father. Now, Walt Heyer is a former transgender female, so a biological male who transitioned to be a transgender female and lived as a female for years, but ultimately transitioned back to male, his biological sex. And he has spoken out on this, saying that the potential diagnosis could ruin the boy's life, something similar that had happened to him. Walt wrote for The Federalist about this case and said, quote, "The diagnosis is critical because labeling a child with gender dysphoria can trigger a series of physical and mental consequences for the child and has legal ramifications in the ongoing custody case. Get it wrong, and the boy's life is irrevocably harmed." He concluded by giving a warning, saying, "If we do not save the boy from a misdiagnosis, his next step is chemical castration at age 8, only 2 years away." And I'm looking at a photo of the six-year-old boy right now, and he looks exactly like a perfectly normal and happy six-year-old boy. Now, I don't know him. I don't know the family. I don't know the whole story. But based on everything that I am reading and seeing about this, it is incredibly, incredibly troubling. Just how is it that we have decided as a society that a child who isn't old enough to consent to sexual activity is somehow old enough to consent to a gender transition? If he doesn't have the knowledge, understanding, or power to consent to one, then they don't for the other. I mean, schools have to get written consent from parents or their permission for a child to take an aspirin at school, but now we're letting them choose whatever gender they want to be. in some cases, like it's happened in other parts of the country, without even informing the parents of what decision the child has made. And now here in Texas, taking a six-year-old away from his father. And for what? For not wanting him to go through hormone treatment or puberty blockers or very major surgery that would have lifelong consequences when he's a six-year-old? This is real. We have got to wake up. And this has happened before. We heard about this in Ohio earlier this year. In Ohio, again, in the Midwest, where Christian parents lost custody. Both parents lost custody of their child for not affirming the child's chosen gender identity. Ideas have consequences, and bad ideas have victims. The laws passed by our state legislature affect the lives of real people, whether they agree with them or not, whether we want them to or not. And we have got to stand up to protect basic fundamental rights, the rights of parents, the rights to free speech, the rights to religious freedom, or we will lose them. As Ronald Reagan said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. This is why Nebraska Family Alliance exists. At NFA, we are working to defend life and liberty every day. And by God's grace and because of our faithful ministry partners, NFA has lived out our mission to advance family, freedom, and life for the last 30 years by influencing policy, mobilizing prayer, and empowering people. And if you're not already, we encourage you, we invite you to join us and stand with us to strengthen families and stand for justice. And if you're not already, we encourage you, we invite you to stand with us and join us in the movement to strengthen families and stand for justice in Nebraska. You can learn more by visiting our website, NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org, and together we can ensure that our state is the best place to live, work, and raise a family. Now, this is a really exciting time of year. It's Christmas season. People are getting in the Christmas spirit. It's an exciting, fun time filled with joy and Merry Christmas greetings and all the great things that come along with celebrating Christmas. But apparently for a public school in Virginia, this now means banning children at the school from singing any song that makes mention to Jesus. So it is, of course, okay to sing about Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but if you sing about the little Lord Jesus being born in a manger, you will go straight to the principal's office. Parents at the Virginia school received an email recently alerting them that Christmas songs mentioning Jesus would no longer be permitted at the school. And this story comes from Todd Starnes, who is a awesome guy out there defending First Amendment freedoms. And he reported on this, that parents from this public school in Virginia received an email from the school's chorus teacher explaining that the school had decided to avoid singing, quote, anything of a direct sacred nature in order to be more sensitive to the increasing diverse population at the school. Now, that sounds pretty nice. We do have a very diverse society. We live in a pluralistic society. But the left puts out statements like this, and then if you oppose it, you all of a sudden hate diversity or aren't inclusive. But explain to me how you can simultaneously encourage diversity and exclude one specific area or group of people at the same time. So if we really value diversity and living in a pluralistic society, you can't have that if you don't also have tolerance. You have to tolerate and truly accept other people who don't agree with you or have different beliefs than you. If you're accepting and including only to those who agree with you, then you don't really have diversity. Now, thankfully, the First Liberty Institute, one of the nation's top law firms handling religious liberty cases, has written a letter to the school telling them that it is permissible under the United States Constitution for public school choirs to perform sacred music. First Liberty attorney Michael Berry wrote in his letter to the Chesterfield County School District, "Federal courts have upheld the constitutionality a public school holiday programs that include the use of religious music, art, or drama, so long as the material is presented in an objective manner, as a traditional part of the culture and religious heritage of the particular holiday. The letter goes on to cite several court rulings that strongly indicate little children singing Joy to the World and Silent Night do not violate the Establishment Clause. And then there's this, more universities and college students being triggered by chicken sandwiches. This also comes from Todd Starnes. Rider University, a private university in New Jersey, has decided that a Chick-fil-A restaurant would simply be too much for their student population to handle. Students at the university overwhelmingly decided they did in fact want a Chick-fil-A on campus, but the university officials nixed those plans, saying in a statement, quote, "We have concluded that due to Rider University's values and goals, which explicitly include efforts to promote the inclusion for all people, we are uncomfortable pursuing Chick-fil-A at this time, and that their corporate values have not sufficiently progressed enough to align with those of Rider." Wow, okay, and what values would those be? It's the Christian values that they don't like, that they think that Chick-fil-A has, but it's only the perception of those values, because Chick-fil-A is a chicken sandwich restaurant. They serve chicken. They don't have a social or political agenda, but the university is discriminating against them anyway, because a founder personally exercised freedom of speech and free exercise of religion years ago. And apparently since then, Chick-fil-A has not progressed enough to get up to the university's level or standard, which apparently includes promoting the inclusion for all people. Quote, "We explicitly include efforts to promote the inclusion of all people." Next sentence, no Chick-fil-A on campus. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Let that sink in a little bit. Chick-fil-A, even though it was approved and wanted by students at the university, was not welcome on campus because they have not evolved enough on the cultural issues of the day. A very recent national survey found that a majority of American teenagers say Chick-fil-A is their favorite restaurant. And that's not surprising. People love Chick-fil-A. This is a basic fact. And of course, they don't have to do business with Chick-fil-A. That is their right. But it is an incredibly poorly reasoned decision. Very unfair to the students. It's hypocritical. And if you know anything about Chick-fil-A, you not only know that they serve chicken sandwiches and waffle fries, but they also go above and beyond to serve their local communities when people are in need or there's a natural disaster, and go out of their way to take care of people and help deliver food to people when they can, as well as awarding $60.5 million in scholarships since 1973. But again, those values not good enough for the university. Thankfully, Chick-fil-A hasn't stayed silent on this. They released a statement firing back at the university, saying in a statement, quote, "Chick-fil-A is a restaurant company focused on food, service, and hospitality. And our restaurants and licensed locations on college campuses welcome everyone. We have no policy of discrimination against any group, and we do not have a political or social agenda." So as we close out the show today, you know, we've talked about some really important subjects today, things that are often very disagreeable and people get in heated arguments over them. And so I wanted to close with something I saw this week on westernjournal.com, Thomas Sowell's three questions to debunk every liberal argument. Thomas Sowell, the famed American economist, has provided a roadmap to use three key questions to engage in civil, thoughtful dialogue that can also help provoke critical thinking and much needed aha moments. So the next time you find yourself in a heated argument or conversation, try first asking the question, compared to what? Compared to what? Second, the follow-up question to that is, at what price? What price will be paid for this ideal to be implemented? This leads to the discussion of, is it worth it or not, or is it even realistic or plausible? The final question, and this one is a doozy, is what hard evidence do you have? It's amazing what happens when you ask for facts and evidence, because oftentimes even when evidence is presented, it's not authoritative hard evidence in any way. So keep those questions in mind this week. That's all the time we have for today. I'm your host, Nate Graz, Policy Director at Nebraska Family Alliance, hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.